Shrink Wrap Radio number 545, Killing It Without Killing Yourself, with serial entrepreneur Cheryl O'Loughlin.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with Cheryl O'Loughlin about her book, Killing It, An Entrepreneur's Guide to Keeping Your Head Without Losing Your Heart, in which she also shares her struggle with anorexia. For more information about Cheryl O'Loughlin, see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Cheryl O'Loughlin, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. I am so excited to be here. I'm a big fan of yours.
That is so great. And I am thrilled to have you here, both because you're a big fan, and that's always thrilling to me, but also you're a high-flying entrepreneur, and you've been involved with some products that I've known about and been interested in, at least two or three of them. And I went out and bought some just for this,
this interview. Oh, yay, thank you.
Yeah, so welcome. And if you don't mind, I'm going to cut right to what I consider to be the punchline of the story, because this is a psychology-related podcast, and then we'll come back and talk about your marvelous career. And so what I'm referring to is, the title of your book is Killing It, which is a double entendre of sorts, because you nearly killed yourself by developing anorexia in the sort of hard-driving entrepreneurial style. So take us through that, if you will.
Yeah, we had gone, and we can go through this in more detail, but I had started a company called Plum. At the same time, my husband started a company called Blue Sky.
Uh-huh.
And so it was two entrepreneurs at the exact same time. And in the process, I was going through trying to get mine up and running, and had a pretty tough, toxic investor as part of it. At the same time, my husband's company, Blue Sky, blew apart.
Mm-hmm.
And it took all of our family finances with it. We lost everything. We almost went personally bankrupt because we had so much debt. We moved out of our house immediately. And in fact, 8 years after we closed the company, we just finished paying off the SBA loan that last year. And so it was intense. And we had two little kids, 8 and 5 at the time. And it was a confluence of things. And so my life felt really out of control. And I started running. And I would run then every day. And then I would have to run at least as much, if not more, than the day before. And, I started eating a little less at the time. And my friends and family started saying, Cheryl, you've lost some weight. And I was like, right on, doesn't want to lose a few pounds.
Right, that's what most of us want to do.
Exactly. So then people would come up and say, Cheryl, you're losing a little too much weight. And it didn't even click at the time. It actually took a couple of years to click. But I began to realize that what was happening to me is that my life felt so out of control. That I had something that was really easy to control. I saw the numbers going down the scale. Mm-hmm. So, I'm a CEO. I measure things.
Yeah.
Measurement was saying that in my mind at the time, I was going in the right direction. And it ended up going downhill from there. And it took me a long time to recover from that.
What did you do to address it? Did you go into any kind of therapy or program or something?
I did. It took me, I had left Plum, and I had gone to run the Center for Entrepreneurial Studies over at the Stanford GSB, did that for a couple years, but I was still going downhill, even though I was in a much less pressure-packed situation. It kept going downhill, and Plum sold. I moved to Santa Rosa in beautiful wine country, and I thought, okay, so everything's perfect. I'm going to take some time off. And I felt still really depressed. And I've still had people telling me my weight was getting scary. And it finally hit me. I've got to do something about this. I have two little kids. I have a husband that I adore. And my life is falling apart. And so I started going to therapy. I went to a therapist one day a week. I went to a nutrition therapist 2 days a week. And I stayed committed. And over time, I began to recover. And I'll have to say, you know, it's not perfect. I've realized that perfect is one of my things that I've been striving for too long. And wow. I can't do anymore. So I take some steps back, but I continue moving further and further forward. And I have so much energy now. And I'm having the time of my life as an entrepreneur, because I've learned lessons the hard way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Boy, was it hard for you to write about that in the book, to kind of expose your, you know, CEOs, entrepreneurs, they're sort of supposed to be heroic, right? Bulletproof.
Well, that's exactly why I wanted to write that. You said it perfectly. You know, again, I was at Stanford advising all these entrepreneurs, and they had dollar signs in their eyes. I mean, they had billionaires teaching their classes. And over in Sand Hill Road in Silicon Valley, there was money going off trees. And everyone thought that I'm going to be the one to make the millions and the billions. And the more I talked to them, the more I thought, you know, they don't know what they're getting themselves into, and they don't understand the ups and downs that come along with it. And even the media does not share that. They share the success and the glory. And we as entrepreneurs, to your point, we're always out there saying everything's great. We're selling our vision. We can't let a crack be seen because, God forbid, we won't get our investment money. We can't convince someone to join our team when we have almost no money to pay them. So we have to sell.
Yeah.
But there has to be a time and a place for us to say, this is hard. And I need help to understand that I'm not going crazy here, that every other entrepreneur experiences this. And I talk to a lot of entrepreneurs who have been through it. Some of them recovered entrepreneurs, as they'll call themselves. And I realize a book like this has to be written. And David, I'm a person that wears my heart on my sleeve. So I felt like if there's something that I can give back to entrepreneurs and even to other people that are going through stresses in their careers, I'm willing to make myself vulnerable in order for them to see that, you know what, that there can be a better way. We just have to learn the lessons.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you know, we live in California. We live in Northern California, both you and I, and there is that in the air, the sort of hero worship of the entrepreneur. And we all are intimately familiar with the Steve Jobs story, for example.
Yes.
You know, and I've read the books. I even had the opportunity to be in the room with him at one point. So,
wow.
So we have this kind of heroic vision. And so I certainly applaud you for having the courage to put your story out there, warts and all. And actually, there's that little warty part, big warty part, but the larger story is so exciting of your really high-flying career. And so let's go get back into that, the positive aspect of that story. And, you've been such a high flyer, it made me wonder about your childhood and maybe what you were like as a girl. Where did you grow up? What kind of girl were you? Tell us about that.
Yeah, I grew up in Michigan, and I was the oldest of three kids. I had a single mom. My father passed away when I was 6 years old. And I was the student that always had to be the best. Talk about perfection. Mm-hmm. I was striving for perfection. I had done this project one time for my history teacher. This was in fourth grade. And he gave me back my paper, and it had A plus 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 plus.
Whoa.
So I thought, okay, here's the standard. So the next time it came back, the next project, I got an A+. And I was devastated. And I said to him, what have I done wrong?
Oh, God.
And that's how I was. You know, when I look back and I think, you know, it was, I really think at the end of the day, it was all in a striving to have my mom pay attention. You know, there were three of us. She was on her own. And now I appreciate after all these years what she had gone through. But at the time, I wanted to say, look at me, here's me. And for her, I was the oldest. And I was really independent. And it was hard to see that I needed help.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the way that I was set up in terms of how I thought things needed to be, and I never let go of that.
Wow. Was there a business model in your life? You lost your father, and your mother was struggling to support you. Did you have any kind of CEO model in your life?
You know, what an interesting question. No one has ever asked me that, and the answer is no. And in fact, what I wanted to, there were two things that I wanted to do. One was I was really interested in issues around social justice.
Okay.
And I wanted to change the world. And one of the things, now talking to you, why it's such an honor, is I had always actually thought the best way I can help people and seeing my mom go through what she had been through was to become a psychologist.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so interested in the mind and how the mind worked. And when I was in college, she said to me, look at, you know, I was lucky enough to have her pay for my undergrad, but she said, you know, I can't afford to pay any more school beyond this. And here, again, I was so worried about finances, given what she had gone through and what we experienced as a family. And, you know, with women, we have the bag lady syndrome. Somehow it's in our genes that we're afraid of losing money and not having anything, not being able to support ourselves. So I was terrified. So I said, well, what's the best way to, you know, make some money right away? So I went into business and I studied marketing, which was the study of the mind. But I thought I sold my soul until, and we can talk about this, my experience at Clif Bar changed my life because I realized that business can be such a force for good.
Yeah. Wow, that's quite a journey. So what was that first step? Was that Clif Bar, an energy bar that I see on shelves everywhere? It's at Costco, and I was at Oliver's Market, and I found it there. One of the things I was struck by was what a competitive category that's become.
Yeah.
There were tons of energy bars, hard to choose between them.
Yeah.
But that's a different issue. So tell us about your time at Clif Bar, how that happened, and what that was for you.
Yeah, well, I was working actually at Quaker Oats at the time, and I just got this bug to find a company that I was passionate about the product and passionate about that it fit into my lifestyle. And I was running on the Chicago waterfront with a running buddy of mine. And this was in 1997. And he handed me my first Clif Bar. I had never seen the product before. And I tried it and I was like, this is phenomenally tasting. Whereas the energy bars at the time were all these sticky taffy things.
That's
so I
right.
thought they were terrible. And I got really excited. And it just so happened in my alumni newsletter, I saw a posting 3 days later, literally, to start a brand management function at Clif Bar. So I jumped at the chance and I go over to the company to interview. And I walk in there and there's dogs greeting me at the door. There's bikes hanging at the wall, but I can't find any people, literally. So I walk to the back of the building, and there's this huge climbing wall, and the whole company is participating in a stretching class. And here, you know, I came from places, big multinationals, where you were taught in marketing, you really had to separate yourself from the product. You couldn't be a user of a product, God forbid, because then you couldn't be objective enough. And I walked into Clif Bar, and I walk into this different world. And so out of the stretching class pops Gary Erickson, the co-founder and now owner of Clif Bar, and his four-year-old daughter at the time. And he takes me over to his office, and he pops her on his lap, and he starts asking me questions. And I thought, here is a man who's talking to me, not just as a company owner, but as a baker, an athlete, a father, a loving husband. And I was stunned. I'm like, my God, this is real. These people are authentic. And I jumped at the chance to join. And, you know, a couple quick things that came out of that was Gary taught me how to bring love into my work. And he taught me about how Clif Bar came out of his love for being a cyclist. So he asked me to dig deep in terms of my soul and what was important to me. And what I realized is that I loved energy bars, but only if I was doing super hardcore workouts. So I wanted something that was a little bit lighter, that I could enjoy, that was nutritionally right for me as an active woman. And Gary, who's a brilliant product developer, baked our first, what was to become Luna Bar.
Yeah, Luma, yeah.
Luna.
Yeah, I've got one, actually. Yeah, I told you. I bought the products.
Well, that at the time, actually, we introduced it as the whole nutrition bar for women, because almost no women were using the energy bar category. And the brand, with almost no marketing support, because we didn't have much money at that time, and it within 3 years became a $70 million business.
Wow.
And it opened up a huge amount of pent-up demand by women who just didn't feel satisfied by the category. So it changed the face of the category from male-dominated to probably more now. I don't know the numbers anymore, but it's probably way more female than male at this point in time.
Wow.
So that taught me something about bringing your passion to work and your love to work. And then fast forward to that, in the year 2000, Gary almost sold the company. And he was, just a quick story on that, he found himself sitting in front of his desk, ready to sign the contract to sell the company, moments away, with the investment bankers, the lawyers, and the company that was going to buy Clif Bar right in front of him. His 50-50 co-founder was sitting next to him, and he took a breath and says, I can't sign. And he walked away from millions of dollars. The company, the other side was stunned. His 50-50 co-founder was pissed. So he took a $45 million loan on a $90 million company just to buy her out. There was no investment capital. And 3 years after that, he asked me to be CEO because he wanted to operationalize his vision, which was to use the power of a company to make a difference in the world. Mm-hmm. And Ben and Jerry's talked about that, the Body Shop. But no, now it's talked about more and more. But at the time, it was absent.
It was radical then. Yeah.
It was really radical. And I thought, my God, my life can come full circle. If we could use the power of the business to do good, they could fulfill my life goals. So I had the joy of operationalizing this vision. And I saw what happens when you connect people to purpose. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have any physical equity. Gary was afraid at the time to give anyone equity because he had such a hard time with his co-founder. But we and every employee in that company believed in this, in that we spiritually and emotionally owned the company. And I was stunned by this. And I just had to do it myself, and I started another company called Plum Organics with my co-founder, Neil Grimmer, and that became a whole other awesome story.
Yeah, yeah. So let's see, I'm trying to get the order here. So you were at Clif, and was Luna a spinoff of Clif then?
No, it's part of Clif, and it's still part of Clif,
yeah.
Clif Bar is owned solely by Gary with an ESOP for employees. It is a huge brand now, and it's incredible what the company has done. It's stunning.
Yeah.
It's really stunning.
Yeah, I'm sort of mourning that you don't own a piece of that, it sounds like. Well, it sounds like you were okay. Go ahead.
So when I started my company, that's something that was really important to Neil and I, is to have physical, emotional, and spiritual equity, all three. Every employee had equity in the company. And the company was all about something that was so near and dear to our hearts, which is our kids. And we were finding at the time there was this great divide between healthy and organic products and great tasting and also beautiful looking products. You walk through Whole Foods stores at that time, this was in 2007, and the products weren't appealing to kids when they would walk in the grocery stores and this brilliant packaging. And although the products weren't healthy in their mind, it tasted really good. And we wanted to bridge the great divide. So we introduced this product called Plum Organics. And we brought forward this packaging that you see all over the place now, but at the time it wasn't in the country for baby food. It's these squeezy pouches that babies can hold in their own hands and squeeze into their mouth. It changed the face of the category. It was all about baby jars before. The product tasted horrible. But with what we were doing, the product was much more fresh and protected in this package. And so what we found, this was really interesting. So we invited moms, when we were just coming out with the product, to give their babies the product to see how their babies would react. And what they did was they actually put it in their mouth first, which was a huge insight. Moms were the ones that were deciding how good the product was. So they were stunned when they tried the product. So we actually, baby food jars was what is called a loss leader category for retailers, meaning that they lost money on every single jar they sold. But when we introduced Plum in these pouches, it was double the price. I mean, it was more expensive to make, but it was double the price. And they were moving in the store the same amount of product as the jars, because parents were like, oh my God, this solves so many problems. It tastes good. The packaging is beautiful. It doesn't break, which was good for retailers and for consumers. So it went from a loss leader category to a very profitable category, and the company Plum just went skyrocketed it.
Wow,
and
great.
We sold it to Campbell's Soup in 2013. So it became an over $100 million business in less than 5 years. And so it was an amazing experience.
And you were a co-founder of that business, right?
And I was a co-founder of that business. Yeah.
And then CEO as well.
Wow,
yeah. You know, one of the things that you talked about in the book that I want to make sure that we touch on is how exciting and addictive that world is.
Totally.
It's we've already sort of touched on some of the stress that is very stressful, carrying that much responsibility and trying to keep all these balls in the air and have it be profitable and so on. But there's something about it that's really addictive. You gave an example that really struck me of an entrepreneur who sold and then repurchased this company 7 times.
Yeah.
It reminded me of my parents were married and divorced from each other 3 times. So there was something addictive there, too.
Hopefully they got it right at the end there.
Hopefully. I don't know. that's another story.
Another time.
Yeah.
Yeah, it truly is. And that's one thing, and we could talk about my company I'm running now, Rebel, but I've learned all these lessons. But it is addictive. It is an adrenaline rush. You're creating something out of nothing. And you see, I mean, walking into stores and seeing Plum on the shelf when we created it and seeing babies eating the product, I mean, there's nothing like it. It's putting yourself, your whole self into the product. And so there's this light side and a dark side, because here everything that drives us in terms of our persistence and dedication as entrepreneurs and willing to do anything to bring this baby into the world and grow it.
Yeah.
But there's a dark side of those same traits, and it's obsession and depression. In fact, there was a study that was done by Dr. Michael Freeman out of UCSF. He also teaches over at Cal Berkeley. He's a therapist as well as a professor. And he did the first of its kind study that showed a correlation between entrepreneurs and things like ADHD, mm-hmm. bipolar disease, depression, manic depression. 72% amongst entrepreneurs, about 40% in the general pop. So it's a statistically significant difference. But again, as Dr. Michael will say, it is just two sides of the same coin, which is, again, the reason why I wrote this book is, you know, and you hear things about suicide in the valley. I wrote this book because I wanted to help people to not go to that dark side. And there's so many lessons in that, in making sure that we're connecting with as a tribe as entrepreneurs, that we're willing to get help and support from each other, and we're not hiding behind this veil of perfection. It's keeping your relationships so important in your life and not walking away from those because we have to go in this dark hole and, you know, not see the world because we're so busy. You know what, at the end of the day, our investors, it is in their best interest to make sure that the entrepreneur is healthy, because if the entrepreneur is healthy, the company is healthy. And I tell entrepreneurs now, you know what, one of the first and best things you can do is get a therapist for your CEO. I mean, no one's taking me up on that yet. That is so important. And so, you know, we can talk about Rebel, but I made very different choices in my investors, and I can be so vulnerable with my investors, and they celebrate that because they know it will make a difference to the company.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Rebel. Are you currently with Rebel?
So, yes. Rebel is a wonderful company. It's a super herb beverage. It's a coconut milk based elixir. So it has the goodness of coconut milk. It's organic. It has fair trade ingredients. And it has these super herbs. And these are herbs like turmeric that is getting really popular for its anti-inflammatory abilities. But also these herbs that are just coming into now modern society and recognizing something that's been around for the millennia. And these are herbs like maca, ashwagandha, reishi mushroom. And what these herbs do, they're called adaptogens. And ashwagandha, for example, now has a ton of clinical research behind it that shows that it actually helps your body to adapt to stress. So if you're overstressed, it will calm you down. If you're understressed, it will give you energy. And so it's the perfect solution in a completely organic form to one of the biggest problems today, being stressed, just what we're talking about today. So believe me, this product is close to my heart.
Yeah. And I have to tell you, I went out and I searched it out, and I think I've bought a total of 5 bottles so far. And I tried the one with the turmeric, I forgot what it's called, in kind of a yellowish bottle.
Yep.
And I bought the 2 chocolate-flavored ones, because chocolate, I mean. And instead of tasting like some kind of super health foody fake chocolate kind of taste, it tasted really good, both of those chocolates, really good.
I'm so happy you experienced that, because people are obsessed with this brand. It's one of the things Paulo Hawken, who is a co-founder and chief innovation officer, I'm the CEO of the company, he is a brilliant product developer, and he knows how to take the purest of ingredients. If you look at that label, it is completely pure and clean, and make them exquisite tasting, just because he so knows how to soulfully craft things. And so that people try it, we want them to come in, because it tastes good. And then through that, we want to introduce them to, you know, how beautiful the plants, as we call it, the plant queendom can be in all of its offerings in terms of its beautiful ingredients, and get introduced to these herbs that have been so lost over all these centuries and are now being discovered today. And I am having, David, the freaking time of my life with this company because I learned the hard way. I am loving the ride. It's amazing.
Yeah. Now, Rebel is spelled R-E-B-B-L, and that's actually an acronym. I love that. Tell us what Rebel stands, what those words of the acronym are.
I'm so happy that you know it. It stands for Roots, Extracts, Berries, Barks, and Leaves. It's what's in the product. But it also stands for the strength of the individual and the power that we have as people to make change in the world. And also the strength celebrates the strength of the adaptogens in the product. So it's, I mean, as a brand person at heart, it's amazing to me what a powerful brand name that we have.
And we were talking earlier about the power to not only bring out a product and build a business and so on, but also to do good for the world. And so 2.5% of the proceeds from Rebel go to something called Not For Sale. Tell us about that. First of all, kudos for doing that. And tell us what Not For Sale is about.
Well, give you a little background here. We were actually started by a nonprofit called Not For Sale. And Not For Sale's whole goal is to eradicate modern day human trafficking, the sex trade as well as the slave trade. Believe it or not, human trafficking is the fastest growing illegal industry in this world. Uh-huh. It impacts 30 million people, 80% of which are women and girls. And we need to address it. And it's a scary topic for some people to talk about, but it needs to be addressed. So this company, this nonprofit, started this company because they were doing work in the Peruvian Amazon, where this is a big problem. And Dave Bastone, the executive director of Not For Sale, who sits on our board to this day, he brought together a think tank of people. And this was a very diverse group of people, which is a big learning there is what you can do when you bring people with very different points of view together. There was an agronomist there, investors, and there was actually a professional baseball player, Jeremy Affelt of the Giants. And they came up with this idea of, why don't we create a beverage using the local ingredients to help bring the livelihood to the people there to protect them against trafficking. And this idea blossomed over time when they brought Paulo Hawken there because he is a brilliant beverage product innovator. And Paulo created this beautiful product that we've been talking about, and the company has taken off. And so 2.5% of every single bottle goes back to Not For Sale to help them to rehabilitate people who have been trafficked. Mm-hmm. And even more so than that, because donation is only one part of the model, as Dave Bastone says so beautifully, what we need to address is not just what happens down the stream with people, but we have to solve the problem up the stream. So every one of our ingredients, we work with the local communities around the world to make sure that people have their livelihood supported, so there's never vulnerable to trafficking to begin with. And so this is a beautiful model of a nonprofit working in tandem with a for-profit company to create a difference in the world. And this brings me such pride and joy. And this is the purpose, David. This is the purpose that drives me. It drives meaning to every single person that works for this company. And at the end of the day, that's what's important. And also the health of the people that are drinking our products. So it's joyful. And we could talk about this some more, but I have never had the pleasure of working with such a team and group of investors that have so much kindness, have no ego, and I don't know, I said I was never going to do this thing again in terms of this day-to-day CEO thing. And I worked for such wonderful companies with such wonderful people. But this company drew me in. It's the most special ride I've ever been on in my entire life.
You got the e-ticket.
I got the e-ticket, man. And I just, maybe just because I have gray hair under these highlights, yeah. I've just been through it enough. And I know those ups and downs, you just can't ride them. And it's going to be okay. And I have a team of people that I trust to make sure that we can get through anything together. I know it.
So it was wonderful that you were able to find such a group of investors, because I gather some of your past experiences showed that investors could be, they could really drive the process and not share the vision and just really be so bottom line oriented as to destroy the higher aspects of what a company might be about.
Yeah, well, you know, I had some wonderful investors at Plum, and I do know that they believed very deeply in the purpose of the company. So I got very lucky in that way. But I did have one that was toxic, and he had a lot of influence. And it was not what I think at the end of the day that he believed, but it was the way he had been brought up, I think, to try to motivate a company. And it was going from one day I was the best CEO on the planet, and the next day he was screaming at me. And it was this up and down, and every day I didn't know who I was going to get when I talked to this guy that it's a pseudonym. It's not his real name. But what I have now is a mind-blowingly different experience. And my investor, Dwayne, for example, from an organization called Bigger, I talk to him every week, not because he wants me to, but because I want to. He adds so much value. He knows how to run a business, how to run this kind of business. My other investor, Mark, also knows how to run this kind of a business. And I will go to the depths of vulnerability with Dwayne, and he does the same with me. I called him the other day on the phone, and I said I had just sold the board on this whole plan and, you know, was rah-rah, this is what we're going to do. And I started having second thoughts. And immediately I called him and I said, hey, Dwayne, I'm going to make myself really vulnerable with you. I did this whole sale and I don't feel good about what I did. And I don't have an answer right now, but I need to walk through this with you in a very vulnerable way so we can work through this together. And so we did just that. And by the end of the conversation, I was crystal clear on what I wanted to do. And I said to him at the end, I said, Dwayne, thank you for letting me be vulnerable with you. And he said, Cheryl, when you're vulnerable with me, it allows me to be more vulnerable with you, and it makes me so much better at my job. And so he and I have said to each other, we are out to prove that there could be a very different model for a relationship between an investor and an entrepreneur. And it's growing. There's more and more companies like this out there, more and more funds. And it's a really wonderful thing, because what they realize is that at the end of the day, having a purpose, having people who feel supported and inspired, that creates healthier companies, and that sustains the entrepreneur, which is so critical at the end of the day.
Yeah. Now, we may have other entrepreneurs listening, because certainly I didn't know that you were listening to Shrink Wrap Radio. But probably most of the people listening are not entrepreneurs, but I think many of the things that you're talking about can be applied in many other life circumstances, yes, and contexts, families, jobs, relationships, etc. And recently you gave a speech to some organization, I don't remember which, you talk about it in the book, and you emphasized four big points, and I'll read them now, but maybe you can then take us through them. Yeah. Connect to your tribe and share what's real. 2, protect your self-worth. 3, bring love into everything that you do. And 4, have bold humility. So take us through those four, if you will.
Yeah, so connecting with your tribe and sharing what's real. We were talking about that a little bit earlier. You know, as entrepreneurs, a lot of times we feel very isolated. And to your point, I think that happens a lot with leaders because you always have to be on. You always have to be almost putting up this air that everything's okay. But we need a place. We're human. We need a place to be real. And, you know, for me, I am very open and vulnerable with the people in my company because I think that makes us all stronger together. But I think in addition to that, we need to come together as a tribe of entrepreneurs. You know, a tribe is something where you just get each other because you're going through the same thing. Mm-hmm. And we need to find each other and be willing to say, you know what? This hurts. This is really hard and I need help. And you know what? Lots of entrepreneurs who have been through it are willing to talk about it. But when you're going through it in the midst of it, it's hard to share that. So we need to connect with our tribe and share what's real. And it's wonderful because there's organizations now like the Young Presidents Organization and Entrepreneurs Organization, my alma mater, Vistage. I'm now with a group of called OSC Squared, which is a bunch of very progressive entrepreneurs pushing beyond sustainability. These are people that we can share our souls. And I have actually something that I say that, you know what, you need to put up the great tribesperson test, which is if you need to be able to cry in front of these people. And this is not just women. I have seen many men cry in Vistage, for example. And when you can cry, it means you found a group of people that you can be really real with. And they're not your employees. They're not your board, not your investors. And sometimes, you know, not even your significant other, because sometimes you need someone just is going through what you're going through to really understand it. So connecting with your tribe is huge. The second one is protecting your self-worth. And David, you know, what I went through and what many entrepreneurs go through is that our identities are wrapped up in our companies.
Sure.
And when the numbers go down, we see that as a reflection of us, that we're mm-hmm. failures. Mm-hmm. Our P&L takes a dip. We take a dip. And I got sucked up into that. And my self-worth equaled my company. And even though at the end of the day, the company in traditional terms was very successful, it was eating away at me. And so what I've learned now is to separate. We as entrepreneurs or we as leaders are not our companies. We have lives that are way outside of that, that will be going on way beyond that if we take care of ourselves.
Yes.
And so we need to know what's important and put those priorities in place, because if we do, if we're nurturing our families, if we're nurturing our friendships, if we're nurturing our health, that at the end of the day will make our company stronger.
It reminds me of the story that you told early on as a girl of getting only an A+ instead of an A++++. So it took you a long time to learn that lesson and to separate the external recognitions and rewards from your inner self-worth.
Absolutely. That's beautifully said. It is that inner self-worth that it is very easy as CEOs and leaders and entrepreneurs, because you've got this outside world who's saying, wow, you know, you're getting on, you know, podcasts and press and it all seems so glorified and, you know, and our identities are all on our products, and we think, you start to believe your own press. And then when it starts to have these bumps in the road, it's devastating. We have to separate mm-hmm. and be strong internally. And that's the work that I did in coming back, my recovery from anorexia, is realizing that.
Yeah, yeah. So number three is bring love into everything you do.
Oh, my God. That, to me, if there was a theme for my whole life, it's about love. Someone asked me the other day at a talk I was doing and said, what's the one thing, you know, if you're at the end of your life that you want to be remembered by? And I said, you know what I want to be remembered by is that I gave so much love and that people felt that love, whether that be my family, my company, all the people in it, our investors. It's all about love. And it, you know what? Being an entrepreneur is too hard to not do it out of love. And to me, you get so much better at your job. That's what I learned at the early days of Clif Bar, when you bring love into every aspect of your work. So, and if you're not loving it, it is not worth it. It is just too hard.
Yeah.
So that's bringing love into everything.
Yeah.
You do.
And your final point was have bold humility.
Yes, which seems like, for any of the literal types out there, it seems like an oxymoron, right? How can you be bold and humble at the same time? And as an entrepreneur, we need to be bold, right? We need to go out there, work. We don't have a playbook, you know, to play by. We're doing something that hasn't been done before. So we have to be bold in selling our vision. And you brought up Steve Jobs. You know, everyone says, well, he didn't listen to everyone. He was just bold and did it. Well, and I would say, and I told entrepreneurs at Stanford, you know, Steve Jobs is a one in a billion. That is not the way that it works. Believe me, I learned the hard way with our company, Blue Sky. If you go to believing too much and being too bold and crossing that line, you're missing a big part of what it takes to be a great entrepreneur. And so that's where humility comes in. And humility to me is being willing to learn. And I love, there's an entrepreneur, Steve Blank. He actually wrote the foreword to my book. He's very well known in the Valley because of his concept, along with Eric Ries, of the lean startup, which is all about that. Here's the quote that Steve says is, a startup is not a company. A startup is an experiment waiting to find a sustainable, valuable business model. So that's what we're doing as entrepreneurs. Our whole goal is to learn from the marketplace. Yes, we need to believe boldly in our vision, but we have to be willing to hear the thread of truth, not just listening to just one person out there, but listening to our customers, listening to other people's advice, and finding that thread of truth. And when we find it, to adapt and pivot. That's what's important. We've got to learn. And I would say not only that, we need to learn about ourselves. We need to know what are we great at and what are we not so good at. Because you know what? Every person in the entire world, even Steve Jobs, is human. And we need to understand that human beings are not everything. So to be a good entrepreneur or to be a good leader in general, know what we're good at, be great at that, and surround ourselves with people that can help us, that can be experts in where we don't have the expertise. And so that requires humility. Mm-hmm. So to me, the beauty of those words together, the tension between bold and humility, is where you find the beauty of your leadership.
Yeah. You know, there was a subsequent book about Steve Jobs written by, I think, a journalist from Fortune magazine that really emphasized his growth over time. And a lot of that image that we have of him is the brash young Steve Jobs. But he actually allowed other business leaders to mentor him as he got older.
Yes, and, he did.
Yeah, and so that's an important part of the story that maybe not everybody has heard. Somewhere in all of this that you've done, you are also the executive director of the Center for Entrepreneurial Studies at the Graduate School of Business at Stanford University. Is that something you're still doing?
No, we actually moved up to Santa Rosa. And from Santa Rosa, for those of people who don't know, to Silicon Valley, that would have been about a three-hour-plus commute, so each way. Mm-hmm. So I left Stanford, and it was a pretty incredible experience. You know, I'd always had this dream in my mind's eye of being part of the university one day with the sun shining in the windows and people talking about all these big concepts. At going to Stanford, it was exactly that. I mean, it was like truly la la land. Even when you walked into the center of the Graduate School of Business, there was jazz playing on the loudspeakers. So it was pretty remarkable, and some of the most brilliant people I have ever worked with in my entire life. So when I moved to Santa Rosa, I was teaching entrepreneurship at Sonoma State, another great local college.
Where I taught for 35 years.
Seriously?
Yeah. I was chairman of the department for 7 of those.
Wow.
Who knew? I didn't know you had any connection to Sonoma State.
Yes, very cool. They're awesome. The head of the business school, Dean Bill Silver, is amazing.
Okay.
And so I was doing that, and I was serving on boards, and that's why I said, I'm not going to do this day-to-day thing anymore. I am done with it. And then Rebel came into my life because I had known Paulo, and he said, come on the board with me. And so I decided to I'll be on the board. And the more I learned about the company, the more I was like, oh my God, this has got the magic that I've seen in the past, the great brands that I've had the pleasure of being part of. And I just had to jump in full force. And, I said I'd do it temporarily, but then I fell in love with it, completely, deeply in love. And I am having the time of my life.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, that's a good note for us to close on, having the time of your life. So, Cheryl O'Loughlin, I really want to thank you for being my guest today. It's been exciting for me. I think, as I remarked to you, I'm sort of an armchair entrepreneur, vicariously. And so it's been delightful.
Oh, my God. Thank you. It's such an honor to talk with you. And I'll just keep listening, and I'll keep being a fan.
As you heard me say in the interview, I was excited to speak with Cheryl on a couple of counts. One, I was surprised and delighted to learn that she was a Shrink Wrap Radio listener, and I'm always glad to hear of a listener who's well qualified to be a guest as well. And secondly, I'm sort of an armchair entrepreneur. First of all, I've followed for some time the exploits of the major talents in Silicon Valley, reading books about them, magazine articles, accounts on the web, and so on. Part of this for me is my mother worked in advertising, and early on, I think that sensitized me to advertising and marketing. And then back in the 70s, when personal computers started to take off, I watched with keen interest, in as much as I had originally been accepted into the University of Pennsylvania with a full scholarship, including room and board, in electrical engineering. As I saw the personal computer industry starting to take off years later, I began to have second thoughts about not having stuck with electrical engineering. I wanted to participate in the computer revolution somehow, and that led to my getting involved in market research, especially for the tech sector, which gave me a front row seat on a lot of what was happening in Silicon Valley. I describe myself as an armchair entrepreneur because I did found my Shrink Wrap Radio enterprise and also my market research business, which is named E-Focus Groups, but I've never hired employees or taken in investors or sought a business loan or even incorporated either of these two enterprises. So that definitely makes me into the armchair variety of entrepreneur. I have to say, I've come to admire those who are able to create a business that supports themselves and their family outside of working for someone else. To me, that is an impressive feat and an important survival skill. So understandably, I'm a huge admirer of all that Cheryl O'Loughlin has accomplished in her business career, and then, of course, her passion for psychology and her vulnerability, openness, and heart are certainly additional reasons for me to put her on my hero pedestal. If you like true life business adventure stories, as well as ones in which the author confronts and deals with a mental health issue, then you'll love her book. If you'd like to get a copy of Cheryl O'Loughlin's Killing It, An Entrepreneur's Guide to Keeping Your Head Without Losing Your Heart, you're encouraged to use our Amazon affiliate widget in the right-hand sidebar at shrinkwrapradio.com.
This is your conscience calling. This is your conscience calling. It's time to give. Time to give to Dr. Dave and his wonderful, wonderful, intriguing, psychological podcast network. Please give. You'll feel much, much better for it. Just click on the donate button and give what you can to Shrink Wrap Radio. You know you'll feel better. You know it makes sense. So let's all keep the network alive.
Thank you, Phil Schneider, for that really fun appeal. If you're not already a regular supporter of Shrink Wrap Radio, won't you please answer Phil Schneider's call to action? And I'm happy to announce that we do have three new donors since the last episode. John Bruce, or maybe it's John Bruss, Lori Gamble, and Ludovit Novota. Let me remind you again to use the Amazon widget in our right-hand sidebar. You can use it to buy not only books, but anything under the sun that Amazon sells. That way, we get a small percentage, and it's just another way that you can help to support the show. Now, I don't know if you get our monthly newsletter. If you don't, you can get it for free along with a recording of a dream talk I gave at the University of New Hampshire some years back. Just go to the top of the left-hand sidebar at shrinkwrapradio.com and you'll see the sign-up area there. Each issue I open with my column, then there are other announcements. We hear from our guest blogger, Isabella Clark, in the UK, and I list some of the guests that will be coming up in the future, and I also feature a listener comment left on our site by one of you. The reason I bring this up is because in my column this month, I discuss what I'm referring to as my digital legacy. It grew out of my interview with Dr. Tony Rumenier, and we were chatting after the interview, and he remarked something along the lines of how great it was that future psychologists, 100 years or more from now, would be able to listen and learn how we thought about psychology and psychotherapy back in the early 2000s. Well, of course, I was flattered, but as I thought about it later, I couldn't see how these future psychologists would be able to listen to the interviews once the website was no longer maintained. I mean, I probably would have passed on and stopped paying the hosting company. My heirs probably would have stopped paying it. So I thought maybe I could give the whole collection to Sonoma State University, where I taught for 35 years in the psychology department. I approached the dean of the library about this, but she let me know that their thoughts about collections were heading in a different direction, one in which the collection would also come with money to help maintain it, I suspect. However, she did ask me if I knew about an organization called the Internet Archive. Turns out that this is a nonprofit in San Francisco that was founded by a Silicon Valley entrepreneur who feels that content needs to be free and available into the future. Well, it took a bunch of work, but let me just cut to the chase and tell you that the first 544 episodes are there now, cataloged and searchable. In fact, I encourage you to go there and test it out to listen to one of your favorite episodes, and also will indicate to the Internet Archive that it's something people are interested in. The URL is https https://archive.org/details/shrinkwrapradio. I will also put this link on our Shrink Wrap Radio website under the About Dr. Dave tab. And this is my legacy to you and to your descendants.
Hi, this is Cheryl O'Loughlin, serial entrepreneur and author of Killing It, an entrepreneur's guide to keeping your head without losing your heart. And you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Cheryl O'Loughlin, who was today's guest. Here are a couple of recent emails from our listener community. First, we hear from Ludo, responding to my thanks for becoming a donor. Ludo writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. After a very inspiring workshop, which I attended this week, it's finally my time to add a drop into the sea and donate some euros. The theme of the workshop was Buddhist inspirations for psychotherapy, along with neurobiological findings. Finally, I got to experience feelings of inspiration and connection with other mental health care professionals on the deeper human level. During this workshop, I was heavily referring to your podcast. Hopefully, I did make new listeners and fans. In my job, about 2 years now, I do work with patients overcoming addiction. A few months ago, I started my therapeutic training in Gestalt. I listened to my first podcast about that, and without your podcast, my perspective on such things would be very limited and rigid, as most of our mental care system is. Of course, your podcast brings me precious information and opens up possibilities, but also a great deal of frustration with the system here, and I learned to use that as a motivation to make some small changes. For everybody who feels the same about Shrink Wrap Radio, I recommend that they donate. Let the sea be filled together. Thanks again for everything. P.S. You can correct any grammar mistakes I make or don't make." And that's from Ludo, who, if I recall correctly, lives and works in Slovakia. And so, Ludo, I think you can regard yourself as a pioneer there, helping to move the mental health system in some different directions. Similarly, Lori also writes in response to my thanks for becoming a donor, and she writes, "Oh, Dave, you are more than welcome, and it is me that should be thanking you. I have been meaning to set up a donation for a while, and after listening to your John Fredrickson podcast, I was like, Lori, it's time. I am an avid listener and embarrassed to admit that I've been listening for the last couple years, mostly during my walks every morning. I always learn something new or thought-provoking and have bought several of the books your guests have written. Keep up the good work and thank you again." And that's from Lori. And Lori, I thank you again. And it happens sometimes that people listen for years before they finally get around to donating. So let that be a trigger for others of you out there who may be in that position. So once again, I think we better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemail on our message phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks again to today's guest, Cheryl O'Loughlin, for sharing the ups and downs of her inspiring journey as a serial entrepreneur and CEO. You know, I skipped putting out a podcast last week, and partly that was due to the birth of our fifth grandchild, Ethan Xavier Van Nuys, who weighed in at 7 pounds, 6 ounces. Congratulations to my son Christopher and his wife Melissa on the birth of their second child. Next week, my guest will be Hannah Bogan, who co-created an accessible resource for teachers, therapists, and parents to support metacognitive thinking skills in primary school students. She reports that it's a good foundation that dovetails nicely with mindfulness curricula emotional regulation programs, and anxiety support programs. I think we all will have a lot to learn. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.